This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Alphas Like Us, written by Krista Ritchie and Becca Ritchie, performed by Alexander Sandis and J.F. Harding.
Prologue. Pharaoh Keen. 4 years ago. I head to the hospital's break room in blood-splattered scrubs. As I pass the ER beds, a few patients side-eye me, not because of the red stains. They scrutinize my dyed white hair and my visible tattoos, the inked symmetric wings on my neck, the writing on my fingers, and more. Basically, I'm far from looking like a poster boy for Doctor of the Year. But I'm not about to slow down or glance back at these patients unless they're coding and I'm called to help. I know better. At Philadelphia General Hospital, I'm used to the constant gawking, and that shit bugs me about as much as water would a shark. I just do my job. I save lives and watch some end. I go home, and unsurprisingly, it starts all over again. See, being a doctor shouldn't feel mundane. It shouldn't feel anything close to ordinary, but it's all I've ever fucking known. And it's getting to me. Really getting to me. I push through a door. 11:54 a.m. Medical interns and residents jam-pack the break room, standing and sitting, talking loudly and eating. Pizza boxes overflow the few tables and counters where a pot works overtime to brew coffee. I don't ask about the spontaneous pizza party. It's always someone's birthday in the hospital, and there's always cake. As hungry as I am, I need to change out of these scrubs. I'm about to reach the door to the men's locker room, but a voice stops me. "Keen, what'd you get?" Tristan asks from across the crowded break room. I comb a hand through my bleach-white hair. Some of the residents quiet down, listening for the answer. Short and stocky, Tristan McNair leans on the windowsill, pepperoni pizza in hand. His sideburns touch his jaw as though he's stuck in the 1970s, and his curious eyes flit to the bloodstains on my scrubs. I wouldn't say we're close friends or even enemies, but he's a MedPeds intern like me. 30-year-old male, I tell him. Stab wound to the neck with a key and to the upper abdomen with a knife. Couldn't intubate or ventilate, so he needed a crick. Morris did the chest tube. Apparently, this fucker attacked a female runner this morning and she keyed his throat. He fell on his own knife. Karma is a beautiful bitch. "Who did the crick?" Tristan asks. My brows rise. "Me." Dr. Leah Young, a second-year resident, almost drops her pizza.
"Morris let you do an emergency cricothyrotomy?"
"Yeah. I made an incision between the cricoid and thyroid cartilage in the patient's neck to obtain an airway. Normally, my lips would upturn, but my excitement towards medicine has waned this whole month of August. I grabbed the doorknob, about to leave. "Your shift ending?" Tristan asks, quickly straightening up and balling his napkin. I nod. "Done for today. You?" "Just starting." He stuffs his mouth hurriedly with pizza. He wants in on that patient. Too bad for him. "The guy was tachycardic and hypotensive," I tell Tristan. "We just sent him to the OR for surgery."
"Damn it," he groans, then slumps and swallows his food. "I always miss the good ones."
I wouldn't have minded trading places with Tristan, and that's a fucking problem. For most of my life, I've wanted in on the action. Excited to learn new things, to do new things with medicine, to help people. Now I'm willing to just hand over an emergency crick and tube thoracostomy. I want to blame it on my 28-hour shift, but I've had much longer shifts and been more tired than this. When I enter the locker room, I shut the door, drowning out the commotion. Cedar lockers line every inch of wall. Most cubbies house white coats, extra clothes, toiletries, some books and snacks. I find mine in a corner. It takes me a couple minutes to change out of my scrubs and into a Smashing Pumpkins V-neck and black pants. My mind tries to reel, but I've done a great job most of my life not overthinking shit. I'm not starting now. By the time I pocket my keys and grab my motorcycle helmet, my phone rings. I check the caller ID and then put the cell to my ear. "What do you need?" My father rarely calls to shoot the shit, and I'd rather cut to the chase. I hear him rustling through papers. "What rotation do you have this week?" he asks, his tone warm and relaxed.
One of the many reasons why the three famous families, Hales, Meadows, Cobalts, his patients, essentially love him. He even has a small ponytail and drinks fucking mint juleps and mojitos on the weekend, but simply put, he's not a laid-back, soon-to-be-retired physician. He's constantly working, and I can hardly picture my father hanging up the white coat. I sling my backpack strap over my shoulder. ED. He knows that stands for Emergency Department. Does your shift end soon? He must be typing on a laptop. Keys click, click, click. Just ended. I shut my locker. I'm in Spain for the week. I heard. I cut him off. Reich Meadows is climbing a 500-foot cliff. He's a skilled professional climber, but the Hales, Meadows, and Cobalts like to ensure if the worst happens, their concierge doctor is present. Right, my father says, a little bit distantly. His attention split. I got a call, and you're in distance. Finally, we've reached the point. Call means medical emergency, and I know exactly where this conversation is going. I lean my shoulder casually on my locker. I just got off a 28-hour shift. Ask Uncle Tripp to take your calls. He's here with me in Spain. I roll my eyes. Shit. I'm not a concierge doctor. You will be after you're board certified, he says more clearly, loudly, assertively. You've joined me on enough calls. Think of this as a test run for when you take over as their primary physician. I shake my head on instinct. I know what I want to say. I quit. Two words that I should be able to spit out. I can tell the old man, fuck you, fine, but I can't say I quit. It has more to do with me than my father. Once I tell him that I want to quit my residency and change career fields, I have to be sure that I'm ready. I have to be able to burn the white coat and be completely satisfied. I can't vacillate between maybe and I don't know. I have to fucking know, or else my father will try to convince me to stay. And I need to confidently shut that shit down. He's the gateway to my freedom from medicine, from a generational legacy that has consumed me for an entire lifetime. Once I open that gate, I need to walk through and never turn back around. Right now, in this moment, I'm not 100% sure yet, and I'd rather speak to my father face to face than say those permanent words over the phone. I tuck my helmet beneath my arm. Let me call you back when I get to my apartment. Pharaoh, he says quickly, concern tensing his voice. I push into the break room and snatch a piece of pizza on my way out. Using my shoulder to prop my phone against my ear, I tell my father, I'll call you back. Wait, he stops me from hanging up. Hold on, I say, and wait to speak again until I'm outside, sun beating down on the pavement. Sirens blare as an ambulance speeds towards the emergency entrance and a couple women in teal scrubs smoke on a wooden bench. I put the phone on speaker to free my hands. Okay. I bite into my pizza, the first thing I've eaten in over 12 hours. The food sits like lead in my empty stomach. Listen to me, Pharaoh. I've been where you are. No shit. I check traffic before I cross the street to the parking lot. I know being a med intern is hard. My father continues. You work long, excruciating hours, and you leave a shift exhausted. But whatever you saw and did today, don't bring it home with you. Don't let it torture you. He assumes that I'm emotionally unavailable to handle his call. I may have had a 15-year-old girl code 7 times in the past 5 hours, but I've never let any of that affect my job. The problem. If I plan to quit medicine someday soon, then I shouldn't be setting myself up to be a concierge doctor. It's that simple. I approach my black Yamaha motorcycle in the parking lot. I'm not that spent, I tell my father. I'm just not exactly excited to take house calls and check a little kid's flu symptoms.
The call isn't about one of the little kids, and it's not an illness.
My brows arch, and I find myself frozen in place. Not an illness. I can't ignore this call. No part of me wants to sit on the sidelines when I have the ability to help, but it's making walking away from medicine that much harder. I kick up the Yamaha's stand. Who's hurt? I ask for details, suddenly agreeing to what my father wants. He knows it, too.
We'll talk more when you're at your apartment. Call me back.
He hangs up first, but only after he dangled a giant carrot in my face. I pocket my phone and put on my helmet, flipping down the visor. And, like a stupid ass, I hunger towards the temptation. When I graduated medical school, I decided to save on rent and room with other doctors from Philadelphia General. I live a little north of Center City in an old Gothic school that was converted into lofts. I don't really give a shit about the original chalkboards or the dark walnut paneling or a city view. Basically, it's cheap with three roommates and close to the hospital. Good enough for me. Inside my apartment, I set my motorcycle helmet on the kitchen counter next to a post-it note and then dial my father's number. The note is for me, the same one I see every other day. I barely skim the scribbled words. Pharaoh, tell your friend that he needs to leave. Corey. Leaning on the cupboards, I bite off the cap to a pen and then push my phone to my ear with my other hand. I fill up the post-it with two large letters. No. I'm rarely at my apartment. Someone else staying here in my place shouldn't be a problem. And to be honest, I doubt I'll even be living in this apartment long anyway. The phone line clicks.
I'll email you the patient's medical history over a secure server. My father starts right where we left off. And then, back up, I interject, not wanting to read anyone's medical files if I don't have to, because I'm quitting on them soon. Flipping through their med history is invasive. Who and what am I treating? I tear open a packet of oatmeal and grab a paper bowl in case I need to leave in a hurry. My father must be moving around. His loafers click-clap on the floor.
Excuse me, he says far away to someone else. Thank you. Okay, perfect. I'll be out at the cliffside in 15 minutes.
I pour oatmeal powder in the bowl and turn on the faucet. More loudly, my father says,
Pharaoh!
Still here.
I hold the bowl beneath the faucet.
The patient is Maximoff Hale.
My brows furrow, and my face scrunches in motherfucking confusion.
Moffy really called you for help?
I ask. It would take 2 seconds around Maximoff to understand how much the guy dislikes needing to be saved, for any reason. Even if he were in cardiac arrest, I can't see him phoning my father. But say Moffy did, then it'd have to be serious.
Yes, he really called.
Shit. I curse as water overflows my bowl of oatmeal. Quickly, I shut off the faucet and I overturn the watered oatmeal mess into the drain and wash my hands. Rarely does anything distract me like this.
He was asking for instances where he should go to an emergency room, my father explains.
I dry my hands on a dish towel. I don't know Moffy that well, but he seems like the kind of person who'd make lists to prepare for things that haven't happened yet.
You do know him, my father refutes. You know all of the Hales, the Meadows and the Cobalts. We both do. Getting to know your patients is why we're able to provide the best care.
I roll my eyes. I'm used to the daily medical lectures, but I don't need or want one right now. My father never removes the white coat, metaphorically and literally. It's who he is, and shit, I don't want it to be who I am anymore. I can't only exist as another name in the Keen dynasty. It means that my life isn't mine, and that scares the fuck out of me. Life is finite. We all die, and when you're dead, you're dead. I couldn't wish my mom back. I have a single memory of her and a handful of pictures. I know that I have only one life, and I need to live for what I love. Not what my father loves. Not what the Keens need me to be. I have to live for me. I quit medicine. I quit. But I picture Maximoff hurt, alone, in need of someone. And I know I'm not quitting today. Still, my father hasn't convinced me this isn't just Wolf Scout earning a preparedness merit badge. I pass the phone to my other hand and say, okay, but this could still be Moffy over-preparing like he always does.
If you heard his voice over the phone, my father says, you'd know he wasn't calm. He was tense, and you know Maximoff. So now what do you think?
There's a reason for concern. I rub my jaw, my pulse hiking a fraction. No more delay. I leave the kitchen for the hall closet. Did you narrow down the problem, or am I going to have to pack a bag with everything? I gather my black canvas trauma bag and check supplies. Gauze, sutures.
Shit, if he needs an IV, it could be a fracture. Maybe possible head trauma.
I hurry. Did he sound disoriented?
He sounded worried and distracted.
I remember the last time I saw Maximoff. I can still smell the salt water and feel the heat from the torches. July, last month.
His family threw a summer party on a yacht and I talked to Moffy for a minute.
I remember how he stared off into space, how it took me 30 seconds just to catch his attention. My lips upturned at the memory. That guy's always distracted.
More distracted than usual, my father notes.
My smile fades fast, and I stuff a blood pressure cuff in the bag. I search for my missing stethoscope, unzipping sections. Maximov fought with his cousin on that yacht, both threw punches, and he's been caught in more than a few brawls before, mostly with hecklers.
Do you think he was in a fist fight?
I ask my father, just as I find my stethoscope in a front pocket.
No, he says. He never calls me after any fight.
I zip up the bag, stand and grab my keys off the counter. Then I remember. He's at Harvard. A 6-hour drive from Philly. If he's badly hurt, I shake my head. 6 hours feels too long. Before I think of alternatives, my father speaks again.
I already booked the private jet, he says. I'll email you the details. You should be arriving at Cambridge in a little over 2 hours.
I nod. Good. And I can sleep on the plane.
Before you board, I need you to stop by the house and get more supplies.
He means my childhood house in Philly, where he still lives and keeps medicine for emergencies.
Mavi's blood type is B positive, and if he has a serious fracture, give him lidocaine intravenously and assess. He'll refuse an opioid.
I know. His parents are recovering addicts for alcohol and sex, and he's cautious around addictive painkillers. My father lists all the supplies, and I mentally file the information. When he's finished, he says,
after you treat him, make sure to write a report and email me.
Sure.
And if you have any questions, I won't have cell service. You can always call your grandfather or Rowan.
I'm not calling Rowan, I cut him off. We broke up last week. I sling my bag on my shoulder and check the plane schedule on my phone, calculating how much time I have. Not much. The phone line is silent. I head down the narrow hall toward my bedroom, phone back to my ear and say,
if that's it, you shouldn't let work affect your relationship. If you need help balancing the two, you can talk to me.
Not everything is about medicine, I say more coldly than I meant. My jaw muscle ticks.
I know you liked him, but it's over. If there's nothing else I need from Mafi, then I'll let you go. That should be it, he says, his tone still warm. Take care.
I hang up and slip into my small bedroom that I share with Corey. A 6-foot metal bookshelf separates his side from mine, medical texts stacked on each shelf. The friend that Corey hates is currently passed out in my single bed, tangled in my black sheets. And he's not alone. A mystery blonde girl sleeps beneath his tattooed arm. Her bra and red dress litter the floorboards. I don't care. At this point, the bed is more Donnelly's than mine. But I'm in a fucking hurry. I chuck my motorcycle keys at him, and they land with a thud on his chest. Donnelly! He squints and pats at the keys while glancing at the nightstand clock. It's past noon, and the potent scent of Lucky Strikes and bourbon lingers. Fuck! Donnelly groans and runs a hand through his tousled chestnut hair. The blonde girl underneath his bicep starts waking, rubbing her eyes. Her mascara and lipstick are smudged. I spot the Zeta Beta Zeta keychain attached to her leather purse. This isn't the first sorority girl Donnelly has brought to my apartment to fuck. She eyes me skeptically while stretching off the bed and grabbing her dress and bra.
Who are you?
I'm about to leave, I say more to Donnelly, but he's not looking at me.
He lives here, Donnelly tells her with a yawn.
He sits up against the headboard and watches her collect her shit. She tugs on her dress, checks her phone, and stands, not paying that much attention to him.
Okay, thanks, Daniel.
Donnelly,
he mouths to me, great lay. My brows spike and lips rise. I mouth, didn't ask. He grins and unscrews a nearly empty water bottle. Downing the last drop, he swallows and motions to the girl, then me, with the bottle.
He's a resident at Philly General.
She surveys me head to toe while tying her tangled hair in a pony.
You're seriously a doctor?
I lean my shoulder on the doorframe, loosely crossing my arms. I may be constantly relaxed, but I'm keeping track of the very last second that I can waste before I need to leave.
I'm seriously a doctor, but I'm just a first-year resident.
I look to Donnelly, which is technically called an intern. He tosses the empty water in an arch, and the bottle clatters in a trash bin.
Same thing.
His South Philly accent is thick. Sort of, I say. I haven't taken my Step 3 exam to become licensed yet. I'm 24 years old and I've already graduated medical school and I have that MD. But I won't become a licensed physician until I complete the USMLE exam.
Donnelly shakes his head.
Unnecessarily complicated. The girl frowns.
What?
She can't understand what he just said with his Philly lilt. He tries to enunciate.
Unnecessarily.
Forget it.
She cuts him off and checks her phone. I'd like this girl to make a quick exit about as much as she wants to make one. I cock my head. Need me to call you an Uber? I ask. She texts quickly.
My friend is picking me up. Can I have the address?
I tell her the address of the apartment complex, and then Donnelly swings his legs off the bed and reaches for his jeans.
Hey, he says to the girl. If you want to come along, I'm going to Wawa for lunch.
Wawa?
She cringes.
Ew.
I almost laugh. Fuck, she hates Wawa? My smile stretches, decently entertained because Donnelly is gonna lose his shit.
Ew? He repeats. Girl, Wawa is a great wonder of Philly.
It's just a convenience store. God, I don't understand people's obsession with it.
Donnelly cringes. Didn't you see my tattoo? He rotates slightly and flashes her the inked Wawa logo on his shoulder blade. She tucks a flyaway piece of hair behind her ear.
Boy, it was just sex. I don't care if a one-night stand is creepily obsessed with a gas station or not, and don't act like this was anything more for you. You don't know my name, either.
You've gotta be, Betty, he says. Betty sounds like the name of someone who trashed Wawa.
She struts past the bed with her high heels in hand.
My name is Sylvia.
I turn a fraction of an inch to let her pass through the door. She eyes my trauma bag and then disappears to the kitchen. 3 minutes left. I unpocket a stick of winter fresh and peel the foil.
See you never, Betty!
Donnelly calls, and the front door slams shut. He jumps into his ripped jeans. Can't believe I stuck my dick in a Wawa hater. I pop my gum in my mouth. You've stuck your dick in worse. I straighten off the door frame. Donnelly buttons his jeans. Nothing worse than a girl who hates Wawa. I whistle. And your fucked up standards persist. He grins and tugs his ragged shirt from last night over his head. He notices my trauma bag, and his mouth downturns. I don't unearth this thing from the closet every day. 2 minutes. Bike keys are on the bed, I explain, chewing my gum. I'll be out for a while. You can use it if you need to. Donnelly doesn't own a vehicle of any kind, and if he's not borrowing my Yamaha, then he's stuck on foot or with public transportation. I veer into the kitchen, not loitering around any longer. Donnelly follows close behind.
You tell your old man about being a bodyguard yet?
I steal Corey's apple out of a fruit bowl and I glance back at Donnelly. Not yet. A while back, Akara Kitsuan suggested I try security training. He owns the Studio 9 boxing and MMA gym, which became a hub for the famous family security team. Donnelly and I were sparring on the mats like we sometimes do, and in a break I offhandedly mentioned being burnt out from medicine to Akara. Next thing I know, I'm in security training and Donnelly joins the ride. Now we're both in the final course of training, and I'm 1 foot in medicine, 1 foot out. Donnelly takes a jug of milk out of the fridge.
Been thinking about when you'll tell him?
I bite into the apple and hold Donnelly's gaze for a short beat. Once I tell my father that I'm quitting medicine to become a 24/7 bodyguard, I'll lose him, and Donnelly knows this. My relationship with my father is built on the notion that I'd become a doctor. That's my worth, my life's purpose. Remove it, and nothing is left. Let's put it this way. I was his student first, son last. Small talk was typical. Anything deeper almost never happened, and sure, he was always busy like most fathers are. But I didn't have a mother, and he didn't hire a nanny or a babysitter to look after me. Instead, he put me in dozens of extracurricular activities, made me fend for myself more than half the time. And one of those activities was martial arts. I started at 5 years old and never stopped. It's ironic that my love of MMA is eventually what led me to the Studio 9 gym, and ultimately, what opened the door to security training. I can't even be upset that I'll lose my father with this career change, because I don't feel like I ever had a good one to begin with. When will I finally tell the old man that I quit? I don't make regimented plans like that. I spit out my gum into a trash bin. It'll happen when it happens, I tell Donnelly and eye the oven clock. 1 minute left. He unscrews the milk cap, but his attention stays on my bag.
What's with that?
My father got a call. I'm helping out one last time. I take a large bite of apple. He chugs milk from the jug. Tell whatever Hale needs you that I say what's up. No, I say easily and head for the door. And man, stop assuming the worst about the Hales. The parents are addicts, but they're in recovery and sober, and they're better than most mothers and fathers that Donnelly and I grew up around.
Can't help it.
He wipes his mouth on his bicep. They're the bad luck crew. I roll my eyes and clutch the doorknob. You may be assigned to one of them.
Nah, I already requested the good luck crew.
He means the Cobalt family. I smile into another bite of apple. Have fun with that. I kick open the door, en route to Maximoff Hale. When I'm in the elevator, I pull out my phone and contemplate calling or texting Moffy for more information. To ensure he's okay, but I don't even have his number. Fucking hell. I pocket my phone. Not long after, I take a cab to my father's house in Northwest Philly, pack the supplies and medicine in my bag, and I reach the airport in plenty of time to board the private jet. Moderate turbulence and decent shut-eye later, I'm on the ground. An unknown source has already granted me access to Moffy's dorm hall. If I made an educated guess, I'd say Security Force Omega is on top of this clandestine emergency. But Maximoff isn't aware that any doctor is coming, as far as I know. His dorm room is on the fourth floor next to the communal bathroom. I knock on the scratched wood, waiting. No noise.
Answer, Wolf Scout.
I knock again. Complete silence, even inside the hall. Most students must be on campus. The old dorm quiet in the afternoon. After another knock and more silence, my jaw hardens. In the email my father sent, he left an instruction.
If Moffy doesn't answer the door, call his bodyguard to open it.
He could be unconscious on the floor. I'm not wasting time or handing over that easy task to someone else. I turn the knob. Locked. No hesitation, I pound my boot in the wood. The door bangs, but it needs a couple more kicks to bust in. I don't even prepare for the second kick before the sound of footsteps echoes on the other side. He's moving. Good. I expel a heavier breath through my nose. The door opens to a 19-year-old, 6'2" celebrity with a jawline cut like marble. Instantly, his forest greens catch my brown, and I meet his questioning gaze. I wrung my tongue over my silver lip piercing and break eye contact. Quickly, I sweep his swimmer's build for visible signs of a wound. His jeans are loose on his legs, his green tee tied on his chest. I don't see an injury, and an earbud cord dangles over his shoulder. He must have been listening to music, unable to hear me knock.
What are you doing here? Moffy asks, voice firm.
He even peeks over my shoulder.
It's only me, Wolf Scout.
I push further into the cramped dorm room before he can shut me out. I whistle at the unmade bed to the left, a Harvard crimson comforter rumpled and sheets bald.
Bad roommate?
I ask and drop my bag to the floorboards. Maximoff crosses his arms, his biceps bulging.
That could be my bed. He nods to the messy area.
No, I say matter-of-factly. That's your bed. I point to the orange comforter tucked into the wooden frame. And that's your desk. His oak desk is wedged nearby, a philosophy textbook cracked open and a highlighter uncapped like I caught him in the middle of studying.
Great.
He rakes a hand through his thick, dark brown hair.
Now that you've Sherlocked home to my dorm, you can leave happy. Mission accomplished.
I'm not leaving, I say seriously.
Maximoff isn't an idiot. He sees my trauma bag. He knows I'm here because of the phone call he made to my father. I don't need to spoon-feed him this information. But we're at a slight standstill because he's not forthcoming about his injury. I examine him from about 4 feet away. He usually has a tan complexion, but he's lost color in his face, and he's sweating.
You look pale, I tell him. He blinks slowly.
Thanks. I tilt my head. That wasn't a compliment.
I was being sarcastic?
My brows rise, a smile at my lips.
I know.
Maximoff grimaces and rests his hands on his head like communicating with me is brutal. The times we talk, I like irritating the shit out of him. But today's different. He's my patient.
Jesus Christ,
he growls under his breath. Mafi, I'm fine, he says strongly, his hands dropping to his sides.
If I thought I wasn't, I would have gone to the ER, all right? You can go do whatever the fuck you do on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm sorry you had to come up to Cambridge.
His apology sounds extremely sincere. Don't be, I say. I'm supposed to be here. Right here, right now. This was my choice. I could have told my father no, but I said yes to this call. To Maximov, and I'm not leaving until I'm sure he's safe. He cracks a knuckle and stares off, lost in thought. I wait and comb a hand through my dyed hair. A few pictures line his desk. Most of siblings are with his best friend Jane. I recognize one group photo from St. Thomas with all the family squished together. A summer vacation. The picture leaked on the internet a few years back.
So you're not leaving then?
I look back at him, his attention focused on me again. Not until you tell me what's wrong, and man, you don't need to describe why anything happened. I can work with a bare-bones story. Not having the full picture will irritate me a little bit. Shit, normally it wouldn't, but I'm already craving to know more about him. I skim Mafi in a short once-over and look away. He's Maximov Hale. I almost laugh to myself. Fuck, he's too pure, too wholesome, and I just got out of a long-term relationship. There are reasons I wouldn't. So many more reasons that he wouldn't. Not now. Possibly not ever.
I cut my leg, he suddenly says, but the words come out slowly, like thick tar on his tongue.
I eye his jeans while his rigid stance hardly shifts.
Where?
My thigh? That's a problem, I say easily. Your femoral artery. I would have bled out hours ago if I cut my femoral artery. I'm okay. I try not to smile because I'll just agitate him. WebMD says you're okay, but I haven't yet.
I squat and unzip my trauma bag. I still need to see the wound.
What'd you cut yourself on? Maximov stops protesting, and he unbuttons his jeans.
I don't know.
I frown and open the packaging on a pair of gloves.
What do you mean you don't know? I was off campus last night with some guys on the swim team. It was dark.
He steps out of his jeans. Bandages wrapped around his muscular thigh, gauze thick beneath. He dressed his wounds perfectly. Maximov notices me staring, and he starts smiling.
Better than you would have done, huh?
I snap on one medical glove.
I'm still better than you at everything, Wolf Scout. Don't get excited.
Excited around you?
Yeah,
I'm never even close.
I didn't mean it sexually, but here we are. I look up just as he looks down, and he swallows, his Adam's apple bobbing. Shit, our banter hasn't exactly taken this route before. Since I'm older and wiser, I decide to eliminate the strange tension with professionalism, and I ask,
did you clean the wound?
Yeah?
Take a seat on your desk chair.
I stand and slide my trauma bag closer with my foot, just as he sits like a fucking board. His gaze plasters to my movements. I lean over his chest, the smell of chlorine rushing towards me. And with my ungloved hand, I grab his Fundamentals of Philosophy textbook.
What are you doing?
He asks, hating to be in the dark, clearly. I put the textbook in his palms.
Read, take notes, study, don't watch me.
Pharaoh,
trust me, Wolf Scout.
I crouch, snap on my other glove, and start undressing his bandage that edges close to his gray boxer briefs. I pause not even one-fifth through when I catch him staring and overthinking.
You don't need to overanalyze what I'm doing, Mafi. Just focus on your own shit.
He glares.
My leg is my own shit. Thanks for asking.
I roll my eyes into a smile.
You're welcome.
I continue unwrapping the bandage while his gaze is attached to mine.
Trust me. Trust me.
I try to emote until he finally gives in and reads his text with a frustrated breath. I concentrate on his wound. Blood seeps through.
Fuck.
I unwrap faster.
You bandaged your thigh without stopping the bleeding first?
He glances down.
It was stopped.
I reach for my suture kit.
When'd you cut it?
He shuts his book and thinks. Maximov pinches his eyes. 3, 4 in the morning. I was out.
With your swim teammates, I heard that part. I kneel on one knee for a better angle. Blood completely soaks the gauze, and I try to gently pull it off the cut. He winces and grips the edge of the desk. Fuck.
Sorry. I discard the gauze in a plastic bag and squeeze his cut closed with my fingers. A couple inches higher, and that would have sliced through his artery.
You were lucky.
I know.
He rubs sweat off his forehead with his arm.
I wasn't drunk last night, if that's what you think.
That's not what I'm thinking. I pull out more supplies. You've been bleeding out consistently since early this. What's your pain level from 1 to 10?
I cut myself off and ask since he's sweating and gritting his teeth.
His nose flares, wincing.
It doesn't matter. I can't take a painkiller.
It does matter. I plan to disinfect the wound first, then administer a shot of lidocaine, then suture, but I change the order and hurriedly unpackage a syringe and needle. He white-knuckles the desk, the room deadens while I work, and he concentrates on breathing. I give him a shot of lidocaine to numb the wound. Then I wipe the area with an antiseptic and irrigate with saline. In less than 2 minutes, I'm done with both, and I start suturing the deep cut. I break the quiet first. When was your last tetanus shot?
I was 8.
Too long ago. I look up. You're sure? I really don't want to open his medical records, and I need him to be sure.
Pretty positive.
I trust him enough. I'll give you a tetanus shot before I leave. I pierce his skin with the needle and weave the stitch. Maximov clears a ball in his throat. After I finish the sutures, I redress the wound with clean gauze and bandage. He slides forward on the chair.
I can do that,
he says, and reaches for the gauze. I put a hand to his chest. My gloves new.
Just relax. He lets out a short laugh. Right.
He cracks a crick in his neck and stares far away again.
Where'd you go, Moffy?
I watch him for a second, then wrap the bandage. No swimming until the stitches are out.
What?
His voice spikes, eyes snap towards me. That woke him up. You can't swim in a chlorine pool with this kind of cut. Maximov breathes out a weighted breath, and he keeps shaking his head. His eyes strangely carry a mountain of emotion, and then no emotion at all. Like he's fighting to show me something, and then nothing.
I'm on the Harvard swim team.
I expect him to say, I need to swim, but he stops there. He opens his mouth and shuts it, conflicted. I raise my brows. Sad? I ask.
No.
He shakes his head repeatedly.
You know.
He licks his lips.
Last night one of my new teammates shoved me in a pile of trash. There was metal and...
He was cut. He looks away, then his tough eyes meet mine head on.
They don't want me here.
Do you want to be here? I ask. He doesn't answer. His face is blank.
I crave to hold his gaze longer, but I force myself to look down, and I tape his bandage.
You should have gone to Yale. Everything is better there. The people, the dorms, the alumni. He feigns confusion.
Really? I heard they churn out white-haired know-it-alls with pretentious lineages and asshole tendencies.
Asshole tendencies, huh? I repeat with a laugh. I think you mean heroic tendencies.
I tell you, I got pushed into fucking metal, and you take that moment to tell me Yale is better than Harvard?
Yeah, I'm an asshole. My smile stretches as I stand up, snapping off my gloves. It's still accurate. His gaze lingers on me for a long beat.
Maybe,
Maximov admits.
It's hard not to stare at him.
I clean up, and I don't let him help. Even when he asks, he's still a little weak.
Why are you here, anyway?
He asks, after I give him a tetanus shot in the deltoid.
I know your father is with my Uncle Reich, but I thought Tripp would be here instead.
I'm known to tag along to calls, not pick them up on my own like I'm in line to be a concierge doctor. I pack up the suture kit, and I toss him a bandage for the small spot of blood. He's been dying to do something himself, and he can at least stick a band-aid on his shoulder. My uncle's with my father, I tell him. They needed extra hands. This is a one-time thing. Maximov thinks hard. I'm gonna be a bodyguard, Wolf Scout. The truth weighs inside me, and as I get ready to leave, I recognize how much is about to be left unsaid.
1. Pharaoh Keen. 4 years later. Present day.
He's going to throw a punch, Oscar Oliveira says, observing my hot-blooded 22-year-old boyfriend. I watch the same scene from the same vantage point as Oscar. All six of us in Security Force Omega guard the double-door entrance of the Philadelphia Orchestra Hall. 2,000 of the richest fuckers I've ever seen fill scarlet velveteen seats. The main level and balcony tiers are packed tight, and a string quartet plays a classical piece on stage, ruby curtains drawn open. Tucked up against the left side emergency exit, my boyfriend looks ready to combust. Maximoff speaks hushed, but his brows furrow and he gesticulates madly, inching closer and closer to the uppity suit and tie organizer of tonight's unprecedented event. I slowly chew my gum, arms loosely crossed, but I hardly blink. I watch. And the 40-something organizer with Gucci shoes and glaringly white teeth visibly steps towards Maximoff. In an affront, my arms drop, instinct about to propel me down the left aisle. Pharaoh, my name is spoken in a warning. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot Akara Kitsuan, the Omega lead. Pharaoh, he repeats, his friendly expression now strict, reminding me not to leave my position. His tailor-fit black Hugo Boss suit is identical to all of security. Not exactly my style. I shrugged off the required suit jacket an hour ago. What remains, a black button-down tucked in black slacks. I run my thumb over my silver lip piercing and I'm my boyfriend. I can't fall back in line yet. Maximoff grows more incensed. His eyes flamed and body bowed forward with fervor, like if he tries hard enough, he can mold the lopsided world upright. I want to be beside him, to ease him back, to hold him, cool him off, even if his fuse has been justifiably cut short tonight. Never did I think we'd end up here, just 2 weeks after I'd detained Maximoff's stalker, who turned out to be Jane's friends with benefits. I comb a hand through my dyed black hair, and I restrain myself from rushing to him. See, I'm still the 24/7 bodyguard to Maximoff Hale, but I'm not supposed to protect him at this specific event. Security rules. And we all know how I feel about rules. Behind me, the double door cracks open and six heads turn, mine included. Oscar grasps the handle, widening the door for a server and a tux. He balances a tray of champagne and descends the aisle. Oscar lets his annoyance cross his face as he lets go of the handle, the heavy door closing itself. It's official, he says. I pop a bubble and tilt my head to the oldest Omega bodyguard, and also one of my longest friends. You've been demoted to a doorman? I finish his thought. Not just me, Redford. Technically, you're the only one holding the door, I say, half interested because in my peripheral, I watch Maximoff shake his head repeatedly at the organizer and force out the word, no. Adrenaline pours through my veins, goading me to go to him. No one's a doorman, Akara says as he texts on his phone. We're guarding the entrance. He pockets his cell, subtly reminding us of the stipulation we all agreed to. Security Force Omega gained a decent amount of public fame after the Hot Santa video leak back in January. Tumblr pages are dedicated to Oscar's little brother alone, and some fans will ask for our autographs when we're on duty with our clients. To keep our jobs in security, we all agreed to a big change. No working large-scale events. Now it's the middle of May, and Alpha is attached to our respective clients tonight, protecting them, and we're here doing a job that temp security could easily do. I lean back casually on my heels and spit my gum in a trash bin. Akara glances down the line of us, from Thatcher to Quinn to Donnelly, me, and Oscar. Any of you want off duty? Because you're all free to leave at any time. No one moves a muscle. The fee inside this event costs $2,000. Out of our price range, and we all want inside to keep an eye on our clients from afar, even if it means being regulated to securing the entrance. By the way, that entry fee is one that Maximoff would never set. This is an event that Maximoff isn't even running, one that he'd never construct in a lifetime, one that has been unequivocally contentious from the start.
I study the escalating argument between Maximoff and the organizer. The middle-aged man seethes, his face beet red, and he sneers a response through gritted teeth, slicing the air with his arm at Maximoff, as though to say, no. And then he clutches Maximoff's shoulder. That's enough. I leave my position and head down the red-carpeted left aisle. Several rows of wealthy pricks had been snapping photographs of Maximoff instead of the string quartet, and their lenses start to swerve towards me.
Price to Pharaoh. The Alpha Lead's voice blares through my earpiece. Return to your position at the entrance.
Maximoff's muscles flex. He places a palm on the organizer's chest to keep the man at arm's length, but they're both speaking over each other. Violinists drown out their verbal fight. I never reach for my mic to reply.
Price to Pharaoh, Price repeats. Maximoff has a bodyguard on his detail tonight, and it's not you. Return to your position.
I've seen the SFA bodyguard hovering 10 feet from Maximoff.
I even know that bodyguard.
Bruno Bandoni is a 52-year-old silent type with the stature of a heavyweight champion. Bald and bearded, I used to work alongside him in Alpha, only because he's the 24/7 bodyguard to Lauren Hale. I don't hate Bruno, but he's one of the more regimented men and he's not fond of me. Tonight, that's definitely not changing.
Akara to Price, Akara speaks through comms. I'm too far away now to hear the Omega Lead without my radio.
Let Pharaoh check on Maximoff. He'll only take a minute.
The event organizer hoists a threatening finger at Maximoff, one angered motion from grabbing his face. Motherfucker.
Omega isn't making these calls at this event, Price says through comms while my stride lengthens. Alpha's in charge, and Pharaoh, if you reach Maximoff, then you're officially off duty tonight. You can stay here as security, or as the boyfriend of Maximoff Hale. Choose!
The 40-year-old's freckled hand clutches Maximoff's sharpened jaw, and I'm close enough to hear the man spit,
Listen!
Instinct rams me, and I sprint the last 2 feet, wedging my body between them, just as Maximoff tears the unwanted hand off his face and then swings. I catch his fist in my palm and walk him backwards.
Come on, Wolf Scout.
Bruno yanks the organizer back by the collar. Every movement, a snap second, shorter than a breath. Maximoff fumes, chest rising and falling heavily, and his red-hot fury still drills into the organizer behind me. I open his fist that I caught and clutch his hand with my hand, squeezing. Maximoff blinks, his attention almost, almost mine. Our chests press together, his gray Camp Calloway shirt, green jeans and Timberland boots, unlike the suits and tuxes in the orchestra hall. It's his way of gaining a modicum of control during an event that's completely out of his hands. With my other grip on his shoulder, I walk forward, forcing him to keep walking backwards down the aisle, nearing the stage.
Look at me, I say, my voice husky. Wolf Scout!
His chest falls, muscles still flexed. My pulse thumps. I skim his striking but also tensed face, and my hand slides across his broad shoulder and rises slowly up his neck. I hold his jaw, I tighten his hand in mine, and my lips veer to his ear.
Maximoff Hale, will you marry me?
He flinches, eyes widening and brows knotting with 1,000 questions, and even more philosophical queries.
2. Maximoff Hale. I overthink about every fucking thing. You know that. But in this second, I let out the first thing in my head. What? I ask, two-edged. Pharaoh stands an inch taller, black hair pushed back, his know-it-all smile stretching to gorgeous drop-to-your-damn-knees levels.
Take a breath, Wolf Scout.
Am I holding my breath like I've just plunged into the deep end of a freezing pool? Maybe. Probably. All right. Definitely. I can't even think about the idea of marriage. Not here. It's something I haven't discussed with anyone but Jane. Wait. Pharaoh raises his brows at me, near laughter. I start nodding, knowing before Pharaoh says,
Man, I'm fucking with you.
He needed to catch my attention. I won't admit out loud that it worked, but it fucking worked. I try to force a grimace. Thanks for that, asshole. Pharaoh whistles. His grin has to be hurting his face. He calls it like he sees it. He holds my jaw, his tattooed hand warm, but silver rings cold. The moment quiets. Our eyes roam one another, and I breathe and breathe, the pent-up rage trying to deplete with his relaxed presence pushed up against my rigid body. He hangs his arm over my shoulder, all cool confidence, his fingers skimming the back of my neck before disappearing in my hair. I inhale a deeper breath. I've let another captain inside my ship, and everyone, the security team, We Are Callaway production crew, my family, the world, you, knows it. Right now, I'm aware that we're in an orchestra hall, so close to the stage that the classical music overpowers our voices from eavesdroppers. But Pharaoh and I are standing in direct view of 2,000 sets of curious eyes. Our relationship has been public for about 2 weeks, and this, touching my 28-year-old boyfriend with a crowd in sight, still gets to me. Most of the time, in a good way. Other times, I find myself watching the people watch me, something I almost never do. Cameras have always been scenery to my colossally strange life. But I notice them more now, and I worry a bit that they're bothering Pharaoh. He just lost his fucking privacy, and this is only the beginning. He said he'd tell me if the press or fans piss him off, and so far, he hasn't said anything about it. I trust him, so I'm not going to overanalyze. My muscles try to unbind, blood still set to simmer from Douglas Cherry, the patronizing event organizer that I almost punched. I'm not proud of it. I shake my head, jaw aching from clenching. I thought I could reason with him, I tell Pharaoh. Remind him that Luna is only 18 and she doesn't want this. I lift my gaze to meet Pharaoh's understanding. I asked to switch places with her. He said no. I offered to buy Luna back, and Jesus Christ, I cringe at those words. Buy Luna. Like my little sister is property. Hey, Pharaoh says, drawing me closer, his hand shifting to the back of my head. Camera flashes spotlight us, and we both rotate our backs to block the harsh glare. Pharaoh lowers his voice, and I strain my ears to hear him over the music. Price is on Luna's detail for the charity auction, he says. It's a little bit disturbing that a 60-year-old fucker won the bid for her. But you don't need to be paranoid. Your dad and mom have been breathing down security's neck all night, and almost everyone in SFA is watching her. My shoulders just won't loosen, my neck strained. I've been in DEFCON 1 damage control mode for the past hour and a half. And by hour and a half, I mean millennium. Pharaoh studies my features. Shit, you're so moral. I stretch my arm over my back. You're so damn cool. How do I become just like you? I ask, sarcasm thick. He rolls his eyes. Okay, smartass. It's a charity auction, not a prostitution ring. I frown, my jaw locked for a long pause. Until I ask, how sure are we that it's not? Maximoff. He starts like this is paranoia, but he pauses. Because I'm not in control of this HMC Philanthropy's charity auction. I have no details. We have no details. I signed on because this, right here, was the stipulation Ernest Mangold made, the one task the entire HMC board said I had to complete in order to be reinstated as CEO, a charity auction that they orchestrate. I'm supposed to be told where to go, what to do. A follower, which I've never fucking been. I finally understood why the HMC Philanthropies board chose this, why they even agreed to vote me out of the company I built and let Ernest take my spot. I've always rejected the board's charity auction proposals where my cousins and siblings were the ones up for bid. I would never in a million light years agree to this unless they had kicked me out and held it over my head like bait, which they did. Pharaoh lets go of my hand, just to clutch my waist. His fingers glide beneath my tee, a and my skin electrifies at the touch. More confidently, he says, "This is nothing but an innocent, aristocratic, stuck-up gala." Our eyes dive deeper into each other, our mouths closer, because if it were anything that threatens your body, your life, I'd break the neck of the motherfucker who bids on you. "Pretty sure I'd break a neck first," I joke. Pharaoh shakes his head, but he looks like he wants to kiss me. I probably, most definitely, look like I want to kiss him. But his tattooed fingers suddenly touch his earpiece, his gaze drifting. While security speaks to him through comms, I can't stop thinking about everyone else's fate at this auction. I'm thinking about my sister, about Jane, my best friend, and then my cousin Beckett, and even Charlie, the four who signed up for this insanity. Sullivan bowed out when she heard the title of the event, too uncomfortable, and Beckett planned to join her, but Charlie, of all people, convinced his twin brother to do the auction. I don't know why. No one really does. Charlie wouldn't say, and we're still not friends. I have a couple texts from him that aren't insults, and we haven't thrown a punch since the fan con. So there's that progress. Really, though, I'm glad I know why he hates being around me. Even if it's painful, knowing that who I am hurts Charlie. I glance back at the entrance where Omega stands in a row. Through those double doors, Jane is consoling Luna in the lobby. My sister went eerily quiet after an old man won her, which led me on a tirade towards the event organizer. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't change it or make it better for her. And I'm trying to be okay with that. It's so damn hard. I rub the back of my strained neck, muscles taut. Pharaoh swivels a knob on his radio before he turns his hand to my neck. "Here, let me." But he doesn't massage my muscle, because Bruno approaches. Our arms fall off each other, almost out of habit. We even add a couple inches of distance between us, side by side. But the Alpha bodyguard can't be here to reprimand us for touching. We're allowed to touch publicly now.
"Pharaoh,"
Bruno says curtly, not acknowledging me as he comes to a stop. He extends a hand to Pharaoh, but not in a shake. His palm is out flat like he wants something. "What's going on?" I ask Bruno. He looks at Pharaoh as he answers.
"Pharaoh is off duty tonight. I need his radio and gun."
Pharaoh doesn't flinch, and he's already unclipping his radio from his belt. Before I advocate on his behalf, he tells me,
"I chose this. It's okay."
My frown darkens. "You chose to go off duty? In what universe?" He winds his earpiece cord around the radio.
"The universe where my boyfriend was grabbed."
"I don't know what the fuck you're talking about," I lie. "I didn't get grabbed." Contesting Pharaoh is like word vomit at this point. He gives me a pointed look while he takes his holstered gun out of his waistband. Discreet. None of the seated guests have a view of his hands. Pharaoh tells me,
"That's cute that you keep pretending I can't see."
His gaze descends my 6'2" build in slow, agonizing desire. Christ. Without tearing his gaze off me, he passes the gun and radio to Bruno. As the Alpha bodyguard steps back, giving me a wide space, Pharaoh whispers with a teasing smile,
"Excited?"
Opposite. I swallow hard.
"You sound a little choked."
I'm dying to be alone with him now, and I dig for the last of my bearings and say,
"Fuck you." "I think you mean fuck me,"
he says matter-of-factly. A growl scratches my lungs, and I eye his lips. The music falls silent. My head turns to the podium on stage beside the string quartet that has stopped performing. An auctioneer in an Armani tux adjusts the microphone.
"Hello."
His even-tempered voice booms.
"And we're back. I hope you all enjoyed that intermission and the excellent performance from Harmonious Strings."
Soft clapping.
"Next up for Win a Night with a Celebrity."
All humor dies in my chest as I hear the name of this event again. It's not sexual, the board has told me. As though my brain is hooked on sex. Because my mom is a sex addict, maybe. I don't know. I'm not fucking sure. But I can't be